Some crimes are so heartbreaking or shocking that they change laws, change society, or even earn the label crime of the century. But the stories that made headlines in decades past aren't necessarily remembered today. I'm Amber Hunt, a journalist and author, and in each episode of this show, I'll examine a case that's maybe lesser known today, but was huge when it happened. This is Crimes of the Centuries. I know a lot of lawyers call it a side benefit of being a journalist, or maybe it's the cost of being one, ha ha ha. In my line of work, though, I personally find them useful and usually interesting, especially when they're really good at what they do. In any case, I know my share, and when you get to talking to them about what judges are like and what courts feel like and if everybody really plays by the rules, you get a lot of different answers, except for one. That's when they talk about federal judges and federal courtrooms. Without exception, this is their take. A federal judge can do virtually anything he or she damn well pleases when they're sitting behind the bench in a federal courtroom. They are God. No one has more authority. You can't even vote them out. They're there, and the rest of you have no choice but to pay attention and, well, homage. Take it or leave it. Their word was the final one. That was certainly true of John H. Wood, a native Texan who, in 1970, became a district judge of the United States District Court for the Western District of Texas. That's a lot of districts. The Western District of Texas convenes in San Antonio and covers the oil-rich Permian Basin, all of the Texas Hill Country, think Austin, and the counties surrounding El Paso. In fact, it covers one-third of the entire U.S. border with Mexico. It is, and has been, one of the busiest district courts if you're talking about felony filings. You can thank the border drug trade and all its incumbent violence for that. By the late 1970s, that violence was metastasizing in ways that even seasoned law enforcement hadn't anticipated. The border wasn't merely a crossing point, it was a pipeline. Former investigator Gary Jenkins,
director of U.S. Customs back in the 60s and 70s, once said if they stopped all smuggling through El Paso, the economy on both sides of the border would collapse. It was such an important area that DEA made El Paso the center of all their nationwide intelligence gathering about the international narcotic smuggling operations.
The cases flowing into Wood's courtroom reflected that. Smuggling, conspiracy, organized crime reaching deeper into American life with every passing year. For the judges and prosecutors tasked with holding the line, it felt less like a court docket and more like a siege. Wood, for the record, vehemently hated drugs and showed no mercy to those who took or trafficked in them. Gary Cartwright, an author and longtime staff writer for Texas Monthly magazine, told this story about Judge Wood.
Fairly elderly Mexican-American who was found guilty of possessing a small amount of marijuana. And Judge Wood sentenced him to 30 years. And a little old man standing there before the judge with his hat in his hand said, Judge, I don't know if I can live 30 years. And the judge looked at him and said, try.
The Nixon appointee was known in those parts as Maximum John for a reason. There was almost no chance for leniency, even on his best days. Need proof? Judge Wood once found a heroin dealer in contempt of court. He sentenced him to 35 years for that alone. Defense attorneys who practiced before him didn't just prepare their cases, they prepared their clients for the distinct possibility that no matter what happened at trial, this particular judge was not going to be moved by circumstance or sympathy or anything else. Wood believed, with total conviction, that leniency was a form of dishonesty, that if Congress said a crime carried a certain penalty, it was not his job to soften the blow, it was his job to deliver it. In a different era or a different courtroom, that might have made him a footnote. In the Western District of Texas in the late 1970s, it made him the most feared man in the room. So it was that big-time drug trafficker and inveterate gambler Jimmy Chagra found himself facing trial in a federal court in Texas on 5 counts of conspiracy to distribute cocaine. It did not take a genius to do the math. The man most likely to oversee his trial was John Wood. This, as you can imagine, did not bode well for Jimmy Chagra. Everyone knew that much. What they didn't know was that it might bode even worse for Wood. Crimes of the Centuries is sponsored by AquaTrue.
Amber, how much do you actually think about tap water?
Way more since we got AquaTrue. It's sitting right on my counter. There's a lot in regular tap water most people don't think twice about, and staying hydrated with genuinely clean water is just one of those basics that makes everything else feel better.
Right, and standard fridge or pitcher filters don't really do much heavy lifting. And bottled water isn't the fix either, since it can carry microplastics.
That's what drew me to AquaTrue. It's a countertop water purifier tested and certified to remove 84 contaminants, including chlorine, lead, forever chemicals, and microplastics.
It uses a patented 4-stage reverse osmosis system, way beyond a normal filter. And no plumbing, no installation, it just sits on your counter.
That's my favorite part. You can watch it work. It's actually pretty fun. And more importantly, the water tastes really good. It's not just fine, it's water I actually want to drink more of.
AquaTrue's been featured in Business Insider, Popular Science, and named Best Countertop Water Filter by Good Housekeeping.
And 98% of customers say their drinking water is cleaner, safer, and healthier.
Go to AquaTrue.com now for 20% off your purifier using promo code COTC. AquaTrue even comes with a 30-day best-tasting water guarantee. That's AquaTrue.com, AquaTrue. Promo code COTC.
Let's back up a minute to get to know our bad guy. Jimmy Chagra hailed from El Paso. His Lebanese-American family originally had a business importing rugs, but the lure of bigger money was just too much to resist, especially for Jimmy. His two brothers, Lee and Joe, were also on the periphery of the illegal drug trade, but Jimmy, the middle brother, was the front guy, and his brothers, both attorneys, handled his frequent dust-ups with the law. A note about Lee and Joe, though.
Joe and Lee Chagra both went to law school and practiced criminal law in El Paso, which made a nice kind of like a real fit there.
This is Gary Jenkins, a retired investigator and host of Gangland Wire.
Lee Chagra will go on to become the go-to lawyer in the southwest part of the United States for drug smugglers and really throughout the South.
So yeah, it's a crew of 3 drug-running brothers, and 2 of them are lawyers. So it would be safe to call drug-running the new family business, and the brothers were at the forefront of the burgeoning industry as it began to make its way into all facets of American life in the 1970s. Cartwright again.
The drug smugglers had progressed from being guys who carried small amounts of marijuana across the border, you know, or maybe a pound or maybe 2 or 3 pounds, to people in trucks moving 100 pounds, and then finally to guys in DC-3s flying hundreds of thousands of pounds, and then finally tons by ship up through the Gulf of Mexico.
Jimmy was a heavyweight, a genuine kingpin, supplying not just Texas border towns with drugs, but filling the pipeline from Colombia northward to all parts beyond. He was charismatic, too. Slick. Journalist and author Jack Sheehan.
Like a lot of notorious criminals, you could see the dark side, but he was immensely charming.
In fact, in 1978, he put that charm to interesting use. From KLAS Channel 8.
Robert Redford riding a stolen stallion through Caesar's Palace and then down the Las Vegas Strip was one of the unforgettable scenes from the hit film The Electric Horseman. The movie production was a big deal in Las Vegas in November 1978, and no one was more excited than high-rolling gambler Jimmy Chagra, who talked his way into a small speaking role in the movie.
Jimmy's claim that the reason he got the role was he provide recreational escape drugs to several members of the crew. And so
it should be noted, the Chagra brothers also generously supplied themselves over the years. They grew very fond of the cocaine they pushed, the parties they hosted, and the women they bedded, despite the ups and downs they weathered. The downs were remarkable, if only for the Chagras' ability to dodge the cops, the IRS, assorted con men, the mob, and the DEA agents over all manner of bad dealing. By the late 1970s, Jimmy was being watched pretty much all the time by agents. So much so that in 1970, to elude them, he moved around a lot. To Nevada, California, New York, and Florida, only returning to Texas when he ran out of cash. This was around the time that Big Brother and hotshot lawyer Lee Chagra was being hounded by Assistant U.S. Attorney James Kerr, who insisted to Judge Wood that Lee was involved in the drug business as well, and that the Chagra family doings should be tried under a continuing criminal enterprise statute, or what is known today as a kingpin charge. That charge requires proof, I'm quoting a summary of a Palm Beach attorney's office memo here, that the defendant organized, managed, or supervised five or more people in a continuing series of felony drug violations. It's something that was designed to deal with the influence of cartels, kind of an umbrella charge that covered a multitude of sins. This caused a bit of legal tap dancing when it came to holding the Chagras' feet to the fire. That's because every time lawyer Lee asked prosecutor Kerr for a copy of all the evidence against his family, Judge Wood would agree with Kerr that Lee was not entitled to those documents as he was actually part of the cartel being investigated, which put Lee in a bind and made the Chagras even more concerned about their odds should any one of their number be hit with federal charges. And because that was inevitable, Lee was prepping for the worst. Then, on December 23, 1978, Lee was shot and killed in his El Paso law office by someone sent there to steal almost $500,000 that Lee was shepherding to its rightful owner. In this case, the rightful owner was the New York mob, to whom the Chagras had grown close. Lee's death was, of course, a tragedy for some, but the chance of a lifetime for federal agents. Because they were ostensibly investigating the death, they could now spend some quality time with Lee's files and his personal and legal correspondence. Lee's death left youngest brother Joe, who had a terrible cocaine habit, to be the family lawyer and keep older brother Jimmy out of jail. Jimmy, by now, was a big spending gambler, running his vast drug operation out of Caesar's Palace in Las Vegas, where he parked himself in the Sinatra suite and won or lost hundreds of thousands nightly. He thought it was fun. Much of law enforcement thought it was a way to launder his drug money. They weren't big fans, according to Jenkins.
Jimmy Chagra is bubbling up to the top of the DEA hit list by this time because he had this really larger-than-life personality. He was just out there. Everybody knew him. He had these enormous gambling habits in Las Vegas. Everybody in Las Vegas knew him. And hey, all that money comes from drug smuggling. This is a tip to all you budding big-time criminals. Keep a low profile, dudes. Don't go out and be the most flamboyant guy ever.
Appreciate the tip, Gary. If you're worried, though, that people like Gary are maybe too hard on Jimmy, here's Jimmy on Jimmy.
I was a megalomaniac, actually. I mean, I had so much money, so much power. My biggest regret is not smuggling pot. I enjoyed it. It was fun. I made money. I was able to gamble and have fun.
Okay, then. I mean, if this were a movie script, Jimmy Chagra living it up in the 1970s would be the fun and game portion of the script. That's me flexing that I've read Save the Cat. Here's Jimmy's daughter, Catherine, speaking to the Fox affiliate in Las Vegas.
You would think a high-rolling kingpin, millionaire, marijuana smuggler would have a little 9-year-old daughter cramp his style, but I didn't. He took me everywhere in Vegas with him. Just so proud to have me with him, and there was no shame in either of our game.
The backdrop to that is the Chagra drug enterprise, which is so complex, I confess I needed a scorecard to make sense of it all. By the dawn of 1979, it included dealings with Boston and New York mafiosos, the worldwide Outlaw Bandidos Biker Club Nation, and a wide range of random statewide punks. That's a lot of players. So it was maybe no surprise that someone somewhere along the line would tell what they knew about the Chagra operation. That happened when a bandito was charged with murder in Midland, Texas. He gave up what he knew about a certain cocaine shipment that was coming their way, thanks to Jimmy Chagra. A Midland grand jury soon indicted Jimmy, who was arrested soon after. By way of how the federal court system divvied the work, Judge Wood had sole jurisdictional control over the Midland docket, ensuring he would be the presiding judge when the case was set to be tried in May 1979 in San Antonio. Bond was set at $1 million, which Jimmy paid. Everyone, especially Jimmy, figured that if he was convicted, he'd get nothing less than life without parole. He was well aware he was in a dangerous business, but it was also a dangerous business on the other side of the bar. Case in point, on November 21, 1978, Prosecutor Kerr, who was now head of a narcotics task force for the Federal District, was in his car when he was ambushed in an assassination attempt while he was stopped at a San Antonio intersection. The assailant shot at him from a stolen van. According to the Washington Post, Kerr somehow walked away with only minor cuts from flying glass. He had managed to duck behind his Lincoln Continental's dashboard just in time to evade a barrage of M1 carbine and shotgun blasts that riddled the hood and windshield of his car. The feds blamed Jimmy and Lee Chagra, who was a month away from his own murder, and insisted that federal officers, including attorneys and judges, be given 24-hour U.S. Marshal protection. Some decided to wear flak jackets as an added precaution. Wood, who would have been shot at plenty when he served in the Pacific Asiatic Theater during World War II, dismissed this offer of protection. That he might need it, he told a friend, suggested he was doing his job right. John Howland Wood Jr. was 62 years old. In his younger years, he had served in the Navy, retiring as a lieutenant. Now in his older years, he loved to deep sea fish and play tennis. He had once been on the University of Texas tennis team, and he was still pretty good at it. He was happily married. He and his wife, Catherine, had two grown daughters. He was a proud grandfather. But he was not a hero to everyone. His overbearing manner and his rigid certainty of his own righteousness ruffled feathers and caused some to question his judicial objectivity and fairness. His pro-prosecutorial rulings were noted, as was his personal and professional closeness to James Kerr. Oscar Goodman, one of Jimmy's trial attorneys, said Wood should have been removed from the Chagra case because he had written to another judge indicating his belief that the Chagra family was responsible for the hit on Kerr. He wasn't exactly objective, Goodman said. Well, Wood disagreed. He said he was fine to stay on the case, which, weeks earlier, had been moved to Austin. After the close call on Kerr, it was moved back to San Antonio. Because of all the shuffling and some of the other more typical legal delays, the May 29th start date for the trial was moved to July. Wood was busy working on other cases in the interim. So when he left his San Antonio home on the morning of May 29th, 1979, his mind was not on Jimmy Chagra. He got into his wife's car, which he planned to drive into the shop that day, but found one of the back tires was flat. Scratch that plan, he'd take his own car. Moving closer to the street, he opened the door of his Chevrolet sedan, threw his briefcase in, and, as he was putting his right leg into the car, took a high-powered rifle bullet to his back. The rifle shot splintered his lower spine and sent bits of bone and shrapnel throughout his body. He was likely dead before he hit the pavement. A young stockbroker across the street was coincidentally the son of the retiring chief judge of the Western District, whom Wood was due to replace in a few months. That man was having breakfast when he happened to glance at the street and see Wood open his car door. Then he heard the shot and watched the judge abruptly shift and fall. James Spears ran to the judge's aid, but found no pulse. By now, Catherine Wood was in the street, cradling her lifeless husband's head. Nobody had seen anything suspicious. No gunman, no getaway car, nothing. For the first time in the 20th century, a federal judge had been assassinated. It had taken place in broad daylight, 8:30 a.m. on a busy weekday in one of the poshest areas of town, and it had been a clean hit. Some would say it seemed professional. The San Antonio police had barely managed to rope off the scene before the Federal Bureau of Investigation took control. This was a strike against the heart of the judicial system in the United States. Denunciations came from all quarters, from President Jimmy Carter, from U.S. Attorney Griffin Bell, from former Texas Governor John Connally, who had been similarly shot by a high-powered rifle in the same car carrying President Kennedy when he was assassinated in Dallas. The attack spoke of anarchy. San Antonio's congressional representative, Henry B. Gonzalez, called it the crime of the century. The San Antonio Express News ran a single word in 2-inch-tall type on the front page the next day: assassination. The FBI knew soon enough the assassin had left nothing behind. Sure, they had all the names of all the people Wood had ever put away or pissed off, but this was clearly the work of a whole different level of offender. Jimmy Chagra's name came up early, but he had yet to be tried on those cocaine conspiracy charges, and the July hearing date wasn't going away. The case was transferred to Judge William Sessions, who had been a good friend of Wood's. He was one of the pallbearers at his funeral and gave the eulogy when the man was buried a few days after his death. If the name Sessions sounds vaguely familiar to the news hounds among you, that's because Sessions would 8 years later be named the director of the FBI and would serve in that post until 1993, when President Bill Clinton fired him after the 1992 Ruby Ridge standoff and the fiery 1993 Branch Davidian siege in Waco. Both of those incidents have been cited as events that prompted Timothy McVeigh to bomb the Murrah Federal Building in Oklahoma City in 1995. But at this point in our story, Sessions was up next to hear the cocaine distribution case, and if the Chagra boys had anything to do with the killing, they had not helped their cause. In Gary Cartwright's book, Dirty Dealing, Drug Smuggling on the Mexican Border and the Assassination of a Federal Judge, the journalist wrote that when Jimmy was told of Wood's murder, he went pale. He said later, quote, "I nearly puked. It wasn't supposed to be that way," end quote. Which raises the question, exactly how was it supposed to be? Crimes of the Centuries is sponsored by Drip Drop. I have been drinking Drip Drop for a long time now, way before they became a sponsor.
You make sure we keep some on hand in the house, and you insist that we pack it when we travel.
Because it's a travel must-have for me. Flights and long car rides both wreck me, and I always find I handle the day after so much better when I have Drip Drop in me.
It's proven fast hydration, built for busy days, long workouts, summer travel, all of it. Because hydration isn't just something you do when you're behind, it's how you stay ahead.
It also uses science-based formulas for rapid hydration so you feel results fast while getting 3 times the electrolytes of leading sports drinks.
It's not just for athletes either. Trusted by firefighters, medical professionals, and over 90% of top college and pro sports teams.
Drip Drop Zero Sugar Plus is a breakthrough fast-absorbing formula with an advanced blend of 6 key electrolytes, 15 essential vitamins and nutrients, and no sugar or artificial sweeteners.
And it tastes good. There are 16 original flavors and 8 Zero Sugar Plus options. Amber, what's your favorite?
Watermelon. Grape's a close second.
Right now, Drip Drop is offering podcast listeners 20% off your first order. Go to dripdrop.com and use promo code COTC.
That's dripdrop.com, promo code COTC for 20% off.
Stock up now at dripdrop.com. Use promo code COTC.
Charles Harrelson's family were law enforcement people. One of his uncles was the warden of the Lovelady Unit of the Texas Department of Corrections, serving at the same time his father was a guard there. Another uncle was a former FBI agent, His brother Claude was a Houston policeman and later a private investigator. Charles had grown up in East Texas and had tried a normal life. In the early 1960s, he had sold encyclopedias door-to-door to support his wife, Diane, and their three young boys. But he had trouble. He was simply not a man who liked following the rules. He was a card shark, a gambler, and likely a sociopath. He was happy to write bad checks, rob banks, forget he was married with responsibilities elsewhere, and leave town with his live-in girlfriend owing everybody money. He was also quite charming, well-read, unschooled but smart, articulate, and genial to a fault. His eyes were a cool robin egg blue. Even straight men found him handsome. He was solely motivated by money, and he enjoyed the company of those who had it and could be easily convinced to part with it. And in his experience, everyone could be convinced to part with it. So when he was hired by Frank DeMaria in 1968 to convince a Houston carpet salesman named Alan Berg to fork over the $7,000 owed him, Harrelson said he'd be glad to help. He'd convinced Sandra Sue Attaway, his girlfriend, to lure Berg into a car and they'd all take a little ride. Sandra Sue Attaway figured their convincing would be of the threaten and rough up variety. Instead, with Sandra Sue in tow, Charles put the salesman in his convertible's trunk and drove him south toward the Gulf of Mexico. Then he stopped at a bridge in the small town of Surfside and shot him in the head. Sandra Sue could hardly believe it. Harrelson dumped Berg's body close by. For this, Harrelson was eventually caught, with trial set for September 1970 in Angleton, Texas. In that case, Harrelson was represented by Percy Forman, one of the most famous criminal defense attorneys in the country at the time. Forman had briefly represented Jack Ruby, Lee Harvey Oswald's killer, but he's better known for defending James Earl Ray, the man who assassinated Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. In the Angleton trial, Forman managed to keep Sandra Sue quiet and drum up some witnesses who swore Charles was elsewhere that day. On September 22, 1970, he was acquitted of the crime. But by then, he had already killed another man, Sam DeGelia Jr., the best friend of the man who put a hit on him. For this murder, Harrelson was paid either $1,500 or $2,000. Sources vary. He got caught for that one, too. His first trial for the murder for hire ended in a hung jury. The jury in the second trial, in 1973, found him guilty. He was sentenced to 15 years in prison. He was out in five. That's when he made his way to Vegas and, having kept up with current events back home in Texas, finagled an introduction to Jimmy Chagra. Journalist Jimmy Sheehan, one of the few news people to ever interview Jimmy, described how that encounter went to the Las Vegas Review-Journal's Mobbed Up podcast.
One night, he's confronted in the Horseshoe Casino by a man who had married a woman who Jimmy grew up with in El Paso.
This is Las Vegas author Jack Sheehan, one of the few people to interview Jimmy Chagra.
And that woman came up to Jimmy in the Horseshoe Casino and said, "I want you to meet my new husband, Charles. He can help you. We know you're in big trouble." And Jimmy goes, "Well, okay." And he shakes hands with this somewhat distinguished looking guy with a pompadour hairstyle who hands Jimmy his business card. And this is the part that just almost defies belief. And the card says, "Chuck Harrelson, professional hitman."
The card also contained a list of other services he could provide. It read, "N-words shot free. Used cars, land, beer, manure, nails, fly swatters, racing forms, bongos, pool, dry holes, sports cars, setups, broads, bets, wars fought, revolutions started, assassinations plotted, governments run, uprisings quelled, women seduced, tigers tamed, bars emptied, computers verified, orgies organized." Quite a business card. Harrelson let Jimmy know he had just been serving time in Leavenworth and could be of assistance if Chagra was ever sent there. A few days later, Harrelson saw Chagra having lunch in Vegas and briefly stopped by his table to again say, "If I can be any help to you." Chagra asked mutual friend Pete Kay to tell him more about this oddball who was passing out hitman cards. Later, it would be said that Harrelson was in Vegas to con Jimmy out of some cash by way of his card skills, but decided against that when another opportunity arose that would prove infinitely more profitable. A meeting was arranged. Now, no one is quite sure what was said or agreed upon. No one is sure if Chagra really meant for Harrelson to kill Judge Wood. But that is apparently what Harrelson came away understanding he was to do, and that he would be getting 250 Gs for his efforts. Meanwhile, Joe Chagra, who had taken over his brother Lee's workload, was trying to cut some kind of deal with U.S. Attorney Jamie Boyd that would keep Jimmy out of prison.
Joe came to me and offered to plead Jimmy guilty to two counts of marijuana, which would carry a maximum of 10 years. I said, I can't do that because he's charged with cocaine, but I will allow you to plead to just one count of the indictment for cocaine, which carries a maximum of 15 years. And he turned me down.
Soon, it would be too late for such dealing. Here's Jamie Boyd again.
I turned on the radio, and I heard a newscast indicating that Judge Wood had been shot and taken to the hospital and was probably dead. I turned to my wife and I said, without even thinking, my God, I didn't really think they would go that far, and I had in mind the Chagra family when I said that.
When Jimmy's trial began that July, the investigation into Judge Wood's death had already had a tremendous amount of men, time, and money poured into it without much to show for it. The investigation, when it was done, would be called the most intense since the one investigating Kennedy's assassination in 1963. It would cost the government something like $11.4 million. Jimmy's lawyer Oscar Goodman and Judge Sessions both acknowledged that it would be difficult for any jury to avoid the news of the last 3 months. They also acknowledged that there was hardly any place in the country where this wouldn't be true. Despite that, the trial was an uphill fight for the prosecution. According to Cartwright, quote, the DEA had conceded that not one iota of cocaine had been traced to Jimmy Chagra. End quote. But Jimmy wasn't the type of guy to keep quiet when he had a captive audience. He wanted the jury to find him not guilty, sure, but he also wanted to maintain his reputation. So he took the stand. His swagger did not play well in the courtroom. He explained to the jury that he had never smuggled anything and that he was surprised to hear that any of his associates would do such a thing. An evident lie. He tried to explain away the many phone calls he had made to Colombia in the middle of the night as his efforts to successfully adopt children from there. But when he was asked, he could not name the children. The prosecution had a little better luck. They turned up evidence he had tried to bribe DEA agents and the government's witnesses. It took the jury just 2 hours to find him guilty of his involvement in a continuing criminal enterprise. Sentencing was set to take place on September 5th. Chagra was released on a $400,000 bond. For a man who spent $1 million a night gambling, this was chump change. He disappeared within a week. He was now placed on the FBI's 10 most wanted list, and every post office in America had his picture tacked to its bulletin boards. And while Jimmy was a reasonably smart man, he was absolutely incapable of getting out of his own way. In January, a casino waiter tipped off the DEA that Jimmy and his family were staying in Vegas, just not in his usual high-rent accommodations. Returned to face Judge Sessions, Jimmy swore he had been on his way to surrender. Sessions then duly sentenced Jimmy to serve 30 years without the possibility of parole at the U.S. Penitentiary in Leavenworth. The matter of who ordered the hit on Judge Wood was still on the table. Crimes of the Centuries is sponsored by Talkiatry. I have an appointment through Talkiatry next week.
Oh, tell people how that actually went, because I remember you were kind of dreading the search part.
It was so much easier than I expected. I did their online assessment, and it matched me with a handful of psychiatrists who fit what I was looking for. In-network, right specialties. And then from there, I just picked the one who felt like the right fit and whose schedule actually worked with mine.
That's kind of the whole idea. Talkiatry is a 100% online psychiatry practice, comprehensive evaluations, diagnoses, ongoing medication management for things like ADHD, anxiety, depression, and more.
Exactly. You're seeing an actual medical provider who can diagnose and prescribe medication when it's the right call.
All 800-plus clinicians are in-network with major insurers so that you're not stuck with paying out-of-pocket or dealing with some subscription model.
The whole process took me a few minutes. Short assessment, match with clinicians who fit what I needed, and I've got my first visit scheduled in days, not months.
Head to talkiatry.com/COTC to complete your short assessment and get matched with an in-network psychiatrist in just a few minutes.
That's talkiatry.com/COTC to get matched in minutes.
talkiatry.com/COTC.
In the months between Judge John Maximum Wood's murder and Jimmy Chagra's imprisonment in Kansas, the federal government had put as many as 50 agents on the case. Now, they'd had tips, heard rumors, tracked people down, and interviewed crime bosses and their associates, but nothing had panned out. They had even interviewed this one guy named Charles Harrelson, who came ready with no fewer than 7 witnesses to swear he was in Dallas on the day of the shooting. They were still nowhere. A few months into 1980, though, Harrelson was arrested in Houston on drugs and gun charges. Figuring he needed to find himself a lawyer who had been down this path before, he hired an initially reticent Joe Chagra to represent him. Joe got on board once he learned that Harrelson had a cocaine stash that would fund his defense, then he was all in. As Cartwright explained in his book, Joe at this point, quote, was spending $100 a day, sometimes more, on his own habit, end quote. Coke now owned him, but it was also doing its best to own Harrelson as well. His habit was, in fact, worse than Joe's. He was now mainlining cocaine, which induced delusions, fueled his paranoia, and meant he was losing control of his own narrative. Joe really had no idea who killed Judge Wood, but he was beginning to think it was Harrelson. When it came time for his Houston trial, Harrelson skipped town. But everywhere he went, he claimed to see DEA agents in the trees and helicopters on the street, spying on him while he showered in random hotels. In one of those random hotels, he wrote out a will asking for his body to be cremated and his ashes be strewn over the newly named John H. Wood Jr. Federal Courts Building in San Antonio. He also wrote that he had never killed anyone who had not deserved to die. When Harrelson finally called Joe from the road, the lawyer realized that Harrelson had gone completely off the rails and was in a constant state of drug-addled incoherence. Within a day of that phone call to Joe, Harrelson was driving on Interstate 10, shooting cocaine into his arm through a hypodermic as he drove. He was just outside Van Horn, a scrubby West Texas town, when he pulled over because he heard his muffler rattling. Let me quote Cartwright again on what happened after Harrelson decided his muffler was beyond repair. Quote, he decided to shoot it off with his .44 Magnum, but missed and shot out a rear tire on the Corvette instead. Motorists reported a crazed hitchhiker wearing cut-off blue jeans, no shirt, several gold chains around his neck, sandals, and a baseball hat, leaning against a white Corvette and pointing a gun at his head. When the police arrived a short time later, they discovered the hitchhiker to be the fugitive Charles Harrelson. He held them off for 6 hours, pressing his muzzle of the .44 against the side of his nose as he babbled and ranted. End quote. Finally, the police were able to subdue and arrest him. He then confessed to the killing of Judge Wood and, for good measure, President Kennedy as well. Back in San Antonio, U.S. Attorney Boyd was leaning hard on one of his snitches, a guy named Robert Comanche Rios, who was making a good living telling what he knew or what he thought the feds wanted to hear. He explained how Harrelson had stalked Wood and his family on one of their last trips to the Texas coast and had, while there, made hundreds of phone calls to casinos in Las Vegas. Now, the new guy in charge of the FBI contingent in San Antonio liked how the Harrelson-Wood picture was beginning to look. Agent Jack Lawn doubled down, did the background work, and saw all the pieces were lining up. Then, out of nowhere, one of Harrelson's Houston attorneys called Boyd, the federal prosecutor, to make a deal. He said Harrelson would plead guilty to the Wood murder, provided that he would not get a life sentence and he'd be sent to Leavenworth, not some crappy Texas prison. Boyd, who really didn't think Harrelson had done it, passed. Then Harrelson gave them all a piece of information about the Wood case that had not been made public, something only the killer would know. The tire on Wood's wife's car had been flat. He said he had known that on the morning he died, Wood was planning to take his wife's car into the shop, but Harrelson had a better shot at Wood if the judge had to step out into the street where he had parked his other car. Harrelson had punctured the tire on Catherine's vehicle to make it happen. Jack Lawn, meanwhile, had learned that a very pregnant Texas woman, later identified as Jimmy's wife, Liz, had flown to Nevada and handed over $250,000 to a young woman she met at the Jockey Club on the Las Vegas Strip. That woman had then gotten back on a plane to Texas. She was later identified as Harrelson's stepdaughter, Teresa. Joe Chagra, getting wind of all this, flew to Leavenworth to talk to Jimmy.
There were incriminating conversations with Jimmy and his brother Joe. Joe learns about what his brother did literally in the visitor's room at Leavenworth. And Jimmy says something about Harrelson, and Joe jokingly says something like, from the way you're talking, you'd think that you hired that guy to kill a judge. And Jimmy shook his head and said, that's right.
The brothers did not realize they were being recorded. The FBI had placed recording devices in the visitation room where the brothers met. They also didn't know that Jimmy's cellmate, Jerry Ray James, had reached out to the feds, claiming that he'd been told by Jimmy that he had paid Harrelson to kill the judge. As a result, their cell was bugged, recording any and all of their future conversations. The feds had also gotten the okay to tap the Chagras' home phones. By the way, Jerry Ray was not a nice guy. At one time on the FBI's most wanted list, he had been convicted at various times of armed robbery, burglary, assault, narcotics, gambling, and weapons charges. So anxious were the feds to put away the killer of a federal judge, they offered Jerry Ray release into the witness protection program and a whopping $250,000 for his work and testimony. Seems a good gig if you can get it. Now, on the topic of taping attorney Joe and client Jimmy, those civil libertarians among you might be questioning the legality of that. The government, for its part, had figured out a way to get around the attorney-client privilege in this case by designating Joe as a suspect in the conspiracy to kill Wood, thus voiding the privilege. The fact that both men were still engaged in an ongoing drug trafficking scheme bolstered the government's belief that their listening in efforts would be upheld as lawful. When the courts had to finally decide if that was reasonable, they sided with the feds, despite that ruling causing a lot of debate in the Texas bar. By now, though, Joe had also put together the pieces. Harrelson had, in fact, told him early on he had killed Wood, but Joe hadn't believed him, even when Harrelson had provided details and a map to where he had hidden the murder weapon. Denial is a hell of a drug. The FBI was now telling Jimmy and his attorney Oscar Goodman what they knew. They were implicating Joe after the fact in the conspiracy and had identified Liz, Jimmy's wife, as the money courier. The woman she had handed the $250,000 to was Teresa Starr Jasper, Harrelson's stepdaughter and a woman he had had an affair with while married to her mother, Joanne. For the record, both Liz and Teresa would later claim they thought the payment was a payoff for a gambling debt. Now aware of what the FBI had on them, the Chagras were in deep panic. Jimmy was planning an escape from Leavenworth and haranguing Joe for not protecting the family. Joe was trying to figure out how he could avoid being named an accomplice. And Liz was telling her husband she was scared. She wanted him to fix it all. He told her to start selling her jewelry. They would need the money. The FBI at this point had 1,000 hours of Jimmy talking to Joe and Liz while he was in prison, and of his family talking to one another. They also had a witness willing to testify that Harrelson had been seen in San Antonio at the judge's townhouse complex on the morning of the killing. The investigation was a year and a half old. And one of their last Leavenworth conversations, before they knew they were being taped, Jimmy and Joe rethought their decisions. Per the FBI recordings, Jimmy said, "Boy, we shouldn't have done that, huh, Joe?" Joe, "Yeah, shouldn't have done it." By now, the FBI had done 30,000 interviews and had amassed 500,000 pieces of information to make their case against Jimmy and his family and against Harrelson and his. A new grand jury was impaneled. Lie detector tests were administered to Joe and Liz. Teresa Starr Jasper was given immunity, and two old Harrelson pals, Hampton Robinson and Pete Kay, both now in trouble with law for other offenses, were, shall we say, persuaded to tell what they knew about Harrelson's stalking of Wood. And the long-missing .240 caliber Weatherby Mark V rifle was found using Harrelson's own map. It was traced back to a purchase made by Joanne Harrelson. On April 15, 1982, Jimmy Chagra and Charles Harrelson were charged with murder. Joanne Liz Chagra and Joanne Harrelson were charged with conspiracy to commit murder and obstruction of justice. Jimmy and Joe were also indicted on drug charges. Jimmy's trial was to be held separate from his co-defendants. Before their trials, Charles was held without bond. The rest were offered bond. Joanne's was set for $250,000, Liz's was set for $1.1 million, and Joe's at $1.6 million. They all found the money. The trial was set to take place in Judge Wood's old courtroom inside San Antonio's John H. Wood Federal Courthouse. Crimes of the Centuries is sponsored by Hims.
It's easy to write off bedroom performance issues as part of getting older. Most guys do. But ED is more treatable than you might think, and Hims makes it simple to find out what's really going on. Hims connects you with licensed healthcare providers online, giving you simple access to legitimate ED treatment options from home. No awkward appointments, no pharmacy lines.
Just complete a simple online intake, and a provider reviews your information to figure out if treatment's right for you. If prescribed, it ships directly to your door.
That includes sildenafil, generic for Viagra, available through Hims at up to 95% less than the brand name version.
And if that option isn't the right fit, there are additional treatment options available so you can find what actually works for your body.
It's straightforward, transparent, and designed to make getting care feel easy. To get simple online access to personalized, affordable care for ED, hair loss, and more, visit hims.com/COTC.
That's hims.com/COTC.
hims.com/COTC.
Not available in all 50 states. Prescription required. See website for detailed restrictions and important safety information. Sildenafil is the generic version of Viagra. Viagra is a registered trademark of Viatris Specialty LLC. Hims is not affiliated with or endorsed by Viatris. The trial began in late 1982. Here's Victor Solis reporting for Channel 5 Action News in San Antonio.
It's been almost 3.5 years since Judge John Wood Jr. was assassinated outside his San Antonio apartment. Today, the first person to admit to his part in the crime pleaded guilty to conspiracy to murder. Joe Chagra told Judge William Sessions in San Antonio he knew government prosecutors could prove he counseled, encouraged, and agreed with his brother Jimmy to kill Judge Wood. Jimmy was about to be sent to prison for life on drug charges when Judge Wood was killed. Joe Chagra could receive a life sentence, but because of his admission of guilt, he's expected to get a much lighter sentence. Details of the plea bargain were not released, but sources say Chagra is expected to testify against accused hitman Charles Harrelson of Dallas.
The trial lasted 10 weeks with hundreds of exhibits, dozens on the stand, and a lot of bickering. The jury went out on Saturday and returned on Tuesday, December 13th. As a few members of the jury wept, the judge read their verdicts. Everyone was guilty. Sessions explained he would not determine sentencing until Jimmy was tried. He had already moved that trial to early 1983 to take place in Jacksonville, Florida. Oscar Goodman was enlisted to represent Jimmy. After all, Goodman was known in Las Vegas as the man who kept crime boss Meyer Lansky out of prison, as he had with dozens of others of dubious reputation. In his opening statement, Goodman said, quote, "We will not attempt to disprove that Charles Harrelson shot Judge Wood in the back on May 29, 1979. Jimmy Chagra does not know if Charles Harrelson killed Judge Wood," end quote. Instead, the lawyer said he would aim to simply prove that Harrelson never got instructions to do anything, and that Harrelson was a loose cannon at best and a dope-fueled psychopath at worst, a man who enjoyed the reputation and liked killing. Goodman's reputation had clearly been earned. He made the disembowelment of the prosecution's shady witnesses, PK and Hamp Robinson, look easy. He questioned the legality of the wiretaps. His recitation of the crimes that lead witness Jerry Ray James had committed, 13 different felonies, seriously hampered the man's credibility. And then, sensing that he needed a little more, Goodman planted the seed that Harrelson was simply trying to extort money from Jimmy by claiming he would kill Jimmy's family if he didn't pay up. He leaned on Jerry Ray's assertion that Jimmy was always willing to give others chapter and verse about his big bad criminal past and his big scores. He even told everyone how he had personally killed men, like this one guy, Mark Finney. Was Jerry Ray sure that Jimmy was telling the truth about these murders? "Yes," said Jerry Ray. "And that Jimmy had offed Mark Finney?" "Yes," said Jerry Ray. Goodman then called Mark Finney to the stand and asked him how he was feeling. "Pretty good," said Finney. The jury was sent out with instructions on Friday, February 3rd, 1983. On the following Monday, they decided he was not guilty of hiring Harrelson, though he was guilty of obstructing justice, conspiring to sell drugs, and evading taxes. Jimmy credited Goodman for his win.
"Oscar was not only my lawyer, he was also, he became my friend. I thank God for Oscar every day."
Still, Jimmy got an additional 25 years plus a $220,000 fine tacked onto his sentence. The Chagra family didn't understand. How were Joe and Liz guilty of helping Jimmy commit a crime Jimmy didn't commit? Judge Sessions now handed two consecutive life sentences to Harrelson. Liz Chagra got 30 years for participating in the conspiracy, with 10 more years added on for tax evasion. Joanne Harrelson got 5 years for obstruction of justice, with Sessions adding another 25 for perjury. Maybe Jimmy had just been unclear or too cocky with Harrelson. Maybe this was just a big misunderstanding between two deeply flawed, deeply needy, deeply unprincipled men who thought they could control everything by killing one man. In the years after his acquittal in the Wood case, Jimmy Chagra confessed to conspiring to murder Wood and U.S. Attorney James Kerr in exchange for his wife Liz being released from prison early. He got a life sentence for those crimes, but before Liz could be sent home, she died in a Fort Worth hospital of ovarian cancer. She was only 43. Late in life, he confessed something different.
"As a matter of fact, when I got arrested, I thought that I could buy Judge Wood off, and I tried through a family member. He wouldn't budge. My biggest regret is that Judge Wood was killed."
Jimmy was released from a federal prison in Atlanta in late 2003. He married a fourth wife in 2005 and died of cancer in 2008. At the time of his death, he was living in a trailer park in Arizona. Joe Chagra was released after serving 6.5 years in prison. He died in late 1996 when his car flipped on Interstate 10 near El Paso. Many still think he was judged in this case unfairly. Catherine Chagra, Jimmy and Liz's daughter, believes the jury got everything wrong in 1983.
Both my parents say that Charles Harrelson went to approach my father in Las Vegas to shake him down for money and told him that if my father didn't give him $250,000, he would murder my aunt and my grandmother. That's what my father told Oscar. When Judge John Wood was murdered, my father was in prison at the time. The only tie that the government had between my father and Harrelson was, yes, the payoff money, but that was shakedown money that my father was giving. $250,000 was nothing to my father. Like, he tipped that in a night. So if he really was going to have a federal judge murdered, he knew people. I'm pretty sure he could get somebody better than some low-level hustler like Charles Harrelson to do it.
Oh, I almost forgot. One of Charles Harrelson's sons by his first wife, Diane Oswald, became Hollywood famous when he got the part of dimbulb bartender Woody Boyd on Cheers. Woody Harrelson then reportedly spent $2 million or more trying to get his father a new trial because he believed the 1982 trial that put him in prison for life had been unfair. This is part of a conversation between him and ABC's Barbara Walters on the news magazine show 2020.
Well, he is in prison right now for the killing of a federal judge. I think that it was not a fair trial, especially because the guy who supposedly hired my father to commit the murder was later acquitted on a retrial.
That's what I've heard.
I'm not saying my father's a saint, but I think he's innocent of that.
You said once that you thought that your father was a CIA operative. Yes?
Yeah, he was.
How do you know? What proof?
I shouldn't get into this right now.
Okay.
This is where we're going to get into trouble.
But this is something that you feel and that you're trying to work on?
Oh, I know it's true, but, you know.
Does it make a difference?
That he was trained by the CIA? Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it makes a difference.
Charles Harrelson had left the family on their own when Woody and his brothers were very young. In 1981, Woody heard his father's name connected with the Wood killing and tentatively reached out to him, even visiting him regularly in prison after 1988. In 1995, Charles Harrelson tried to escape from the Atlanta federal facility where he was held. That prompted a move to an even more secure prison, a supermax prison in Fremont County, Colorado. The effort to get him a new trial, funded by his middle son, was put forward in a motion that was denied. In recent years, Oscar-winning actor and good friend Matthew McConaughey has suggested, maybe jokingly, that he and Woody might actually be half-brothers. He says that his mother knew Woody's father at a time when she was separated from her husband. As far as I know, no DNA tests have been done, and McConaughey's mother, Mary Kathleen, known to her friends as Kay, has said they met in Greece when Charles was on furlough from prison in early 1969, but she stayed mum on the question of paternity of McConaughey. The timing would line up. It is too late for Charles Harrelson, the ever gregarious, ever ambitious murderer, to comment. He was found dead in his cell in Colorado on March 15, 2007. Cause of death was a heart attack. He was 68. As for the impact of the Wood killing on U.S. jurisprudence, that's a tough call. Some have maintained it was the one case the FBI had to solve at all costs. At a time when drug cartels were emboldened, it would not do for kingpins to think they could stop prosecution with a well-placed bullet. Further, it showed how serious and how unafraid the government's lawyers were and how far they would go to preserve the integrity of the rule of law. Since Wood's death, such deaths have become more frequent. Richard J. Duranko, a judge for the Southern District of New York, was killed by an unsuccessful plaintiff's father. Circuit Judge Robert Smith Vance was killed in 1989 by a mail bomb sent by a man upset about a decision that Vance had no role in. In 2001, Assistant U.S. Attorney Thomas Wales, a federal prosecutor and gun control advocate, was shot and killed in his Seattle home. The case is unsolved, but all signs point to it being a professional hit. U.S. District Judge John Roll was shot and killed in 2011 in the same Arizona incident that severely injured U.S. Representative Gabby Giffords. And in 2021, Sandra J. Feuerstein, a federal judge for the Eastern District of New York, was killed in an unsolved hit-and-run accident in Boca Raton. So no, judges aren't safer. They're still gods in their courtrooms. That part hasn't changed. The problem is, they have to leave eventually. To research this case, journalist Amy Wilson read Gary Cartwright's Dirty Dealing, Drug Smuggling on the Mexican Border and the Assassination of a Federal Judge. She read all of Cartwright's work on the case in Texas Monthly as the case unfolded. She also read Run, Brother, Run, a memoir of murder in my family by David Berg, the brother of Harrelson's first hit, and she read various news accounts as the cases rolled through the 1980s. Crimes of the Centuries is available early and ad-free through Grabbag Collab. Head to www.grabbagcollab.com for exclusive content related to this show and access to other series on our profit-sharing network. Unless noted in the citations, this case was researched and written by me, Amber Hunt, and produced by Henry Lavoie. Original music is by Bruce Hunt, Andrew Higley, and sometimes my child, Hunt Van Benskoten. Other music comes from Epidemic Sound. If you like the show, please help us out by rating and reviewing on Apple Podcasts. Also, tell your friends. For more information or to recommend a case, go to centuriespod.com. On Instagram, we're @centuriespod, and you can find us on the Crimes of the Centuries Facebook page.